Robert Stark. I am joined here with Scott Smith. He is running for president as an independent. Scott, great having you on the show.
Nice to be on your show, Robert.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what are some of the things that inspired you to run for president?
Well, it's really the platform that I am hoping to give some publicity to. I've always been somebody who gets involved in something that is the cutting edge, and I'm used to a certain period of time going by in which you feel like you're talking in the wind and hear nothing back, and I've always enjoyed that challenge. It's been an entrepreneurial type of a thing for me, and that's happened on a couple of different major things. At some point in time, if you persist, an idea begins to catch on. And then as that idea begins to catch on, it hits a critical mass, and then it rises to the point that there is a general public awareness of that. Whether we will accomplish that in this particular 2016 time frame or not remains to be seen. We've only started to put some effort in that. But what I can say is those people that we have talked to, whether they are financially sophisticated people on Wall Street, some retired members of congressmen recently, people in think tanks in D.C., and just, the average Joe out there, when they hear about these ideas, there's a little bit initially of a, that's wonderful, but it sounds too good to be true. And then as they dig in deeper, they begin to get passionate. And then the comment is, why is this not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal? And my answer is always, it's just not there yet. It will be someday.
I think the first initial response people hear, your proposals include abolishing the income tax, paying off the national deficit, but doing all that without cutting social services. So a lot of people hear that and they say that's very grandiose. It sounds
right.
Like too good to be true. So how do you actually go forth and implement those goals?
So it's all in the math, and the cornerstone to the idea is not just abolishing income tax, but replacing it with something that's more powerful, of course. And that's what is I sometimes call a payments tax or financial settlements tax. Financial settlement is a more technical term for it. That's what you would call it on Wall Street. Payments tax is something that people would understand. So in other words, every time somebody receives a payment, that payment actually has a tiny amount shaved off of it. The good news in that is that there are so many payments. If you set income aside and you look at the total amount of payments made in our nation on an annual basis, the figure is staggering. It's $4,500 trillion.
So the revenue generated from a financial transaction tax would be much greater than what our current income tax generates?
Well, you have to be careful with the term financial transaction tax, because that is being used today. And Bernie Sanders uses that. A number of people in Europe are talking about that. And generally, when they're talking about a financial transactions tax, they're talking about Wall Street, maybe the commodities exchange. So they're taking a single exchange, and they're saying, let's tax that. The problem with that is while the total volume of transactions on the New York Stock Exchange is greater than the total amount of income in our country, it's not that much greater. And it's on the order of 3 to 5 times the income. So if you were to try to tax every stock transaction on Wall Street at a rate of 1%, you wouldn't raise nearly enough money. And you'd probably greatly slow down Wall Street, the New York Stock Exchange. Payments tax is a much broader base than that. It's 300 times the size of our income. So there's a lot of money that is going through channels out there that are well documented by the Federal Reserve. That's where I get my data. And that are easy to tap because they go through highly regulated financial settlers who could shave a tenth off each time something went through. So you've got to be careful with the term financial transaction, because financial settlement is technically a financial transaction, but it's a subset. Financial transactions are a subset of all the financial settlements.
I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein. Alex, do you want to ask a question?
Sure, yeah. You know, you were just mentioning Bernie Sanders before and Wall Street, and
yeah.
I was sort of taking it that people like Bernie Sanders and of that kind of ilk, they overrate the influence of Wall Street on our economy. Is that true?
So I would – short answer is yes and no.
Okay.
The yes part of the answer is Wall Street, as you would read about it in the Wall Street Journal, just say the New York Stock Exchange or the American Stock Exchange, is probably overrated in terms of its impact on the economy. And I'm not saying it doesn't have a big impact. A serious downturn because of the jitters in the New York Stock Exchange has a chilling effect on the rest of the material economy that is often unwarranted and certainly unfair. But what I'm saying is that the monetary economy, okay, versus the material economy we live in, is much bigger than Wall Street. And if you start to look at those types of transactions, they have a life of their own. They certainly get stimulated by a booming material economy. They probably don't, they're somewhat independent. They constantly chug along. Things like what I say negatively impact our economy would be the debt service, the debt that we cover, the cost of debt in general in our economy, the cost of debt within mortgages in terms of the interest rate. All of that, that does have a pronounced sucking effect on the economy, sucking out the energy of the economy. One of the proposals that I make is called Banking 2.0, and that actually has a number of advocates to it today who look at that and say, truly, you're identifying in the cost of financial services here something that has an equal impact to income taxes in terms of the energy that it sucks out of the average worker, wage earners.
I was listening to one of your videos. You made the point that if someone buys a house with the cost of the mortgage payments, they basically pay for their house twice.
Good point. Exactly. So in other words, you're paying twice as much for housing as you need to. And we accept that. And under the old paradigm, let me be the first to say there was no alternative. Under the old banking system in which funds have to be attracted by financial institutions, they have to pay interest for that, and then they have a cost of funds and they have to lend that out. You have to add to that cost of funds, and therein you have the cost of a mortgage today. But there's a differentiator. It's something we could do very differently. Today, we don't really have to have a cost of funds because the Federal Reserve is our source of capital. And if we were to treat it as a true central bank, banks could be storefronts to the Federal Reserve. They could be service agent, if you will. And the money that you would deposit in the bank, this is what I call Banking 2.0, would be lodged with the Federal Reserve. So you no longer have to worry about, is your bank big enough to pay you back or whatever. But when the bank went to make a loan, it would receive its money from the Federal Reserve at no cost, no interest rate, and it would get an origination fee for making the loan, as it does today, and it would receive a small servicing fee, as a servicer does today, but there would be no cost to the interest. And that would cut the cost of a mortgage in half. That would have a tremendous impact on the economy. Now, you would have to change the lending parameters So in other words, today you can borrow 30% of your salary can be used towards paying a mortgage. And if you cut the cost of mortgages in half that way, you would have to change that lending parameter so you can only borrow 15% of your income. Otherwise, it'll be a self-defeating program and the cost of housing will double overnight and you won't have gained anything out of banking 2.0.
So the Federal Reserve, it's like privately owned basically at this point.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, so how would you, you know, so I mean, I was listening to this Banking 2.0 stuff earlier today, and I was thinking, like, yeah, this sounds really good, but the problem is the Federal Reserve is not really, it's not public. So, yeah, how do you feel about that?
I would agree with you. It's not set up currently to serve as a true central bank would. A true central bank would be owned by the people, for the people. It would be owned by the government. It would be like Rocky Mountain National Park. It's owned by us. And so a true central bank serves only the purpose of the citizens, and that would be what would warrant it not to charge any interest. Now, it would be interesting as this debate occurs, because some people argue that the private nature of the Federal Reserve is more sort of a custodial type of a thing, and it's not, you know, it's not a group of the Illuminati profiteering on the rest of society. And other people say that's exactly what it is. And the nature of the fight that would ensue when you propose Banking 2.0 would illuminate some of the truth there.
Your proposals sort of address a lot of the concerns of both liberals and conservatives, because the main battle in politics is conservatives say we need to pay off our deficit and cut taxes by cutting social programs, and then liberals say we need to raise taxes on the wealthy to pay for social programs. But your solutions address both of those concerns, and not only that, there's also the issue of with an income tax. The whole thing with the Panama Papers exposes how a lot of the ultra-wealthy are able to avoid paying income tax. So this
That's only right.
addresses both concerns of liberals and conservatives. It has a tax system where it's makes it so people can't easily avoid paying income taxes. Or there wouldn't be an income tax, but avoid paying taxes.
That's right. You nailed it. There's two things that happen if you eliminate income tax and then put a payments tax in. One is this whole problem of inversions, in which multinational corporations will site themselves in a more favorable tax zone. What would happen is those multinational corporations would be coming back to the United States in droves, because we would have the lower tax basis, and you would find European and Asian companies coming over here too. So the one of the concerns that an analyst typically has when they look at what I'm proposing is the first reaction is, hey, if you're taxing these payments this way, financial settlements this way, aren't they going to slow down? And the actual analysis, once you begin to run the impact on everything, no, financial settlements will increase. They'll pick up, because you'll have a lot of capital flowing into the United States that's been parked offshore, and you'll have foreign capital flowing in. You'll have the economy doing very well, and so that financial settlements will actually pick up under this scenario.
And the thing with your campaign is even if you don't win, because the system is basically the way it is it's rigged against independent candidates, you could still get your ideas out there
and
really have an impact on other candidates. I know you actually put
out an ad
in the Wall Street Journal addressing Donald Trump and
trying
to put to his attention your economic ideas.
That's right. And so that's my goal. My hope is that sometime this summer, late summer, that these ideas are getting some press, and people like Donald Trump or Cruz or whoever wins the Republican nomination, Hillary Clinton and Sanders, are being posed questions saying, all this talk about financial settlements tax, where do you stand? And it's an interesting one, because as you say, this appeals to liberals and conservatives. And so the question very quickly becomes, why wouldn't you do this? You know, why wouldn't you do this? And when I say I've always been a cutting edge, I've always been in complex systems, and I look at where is the paradigm shift that's necessary in order for that complex system, which might have serious problems, suddenly be corrected. And so if you kind of step back and you think about our economy for a while, what becomes very apparent is that technology has driven the efficiency of production, okay? So today, really, we can produce more than we ever could in the past. That's no longer the main problem of businesses. And that, historically, has always been the big problem of businesses, providing enough for the population. We take it for granted that that's not a problem today. Our operating system, our financial system, our taxation system grew up around that old system of scarcity. And so we really are not in a situation where we as a society cannot provide plenty for the poor, for the middle class, why we cannot have really across the board, whether we're poor, middle class, or wealthier, when factories are idled, when the production could be so much higher than it is today, we could all be better off than we are. What we have is a financial system that sort of stymies itself, and we're living in the shadow of that. It's only us that we're harming that way. And so when you're in that situation and not recognizing that a paradigm shift is in order and could change things, then you're wringing your hands saying, oh, my God, we have to reduce taxes, and, well, the welfare is costing us too much. So I'll give you a really powerful number. This is a real powerful compare and contrast. Today, if you're earning $100,000 and you're a single individual, not married, no kids, you're taxed at around a little over $30,000. Out of that, around $9,000 of that is going towards Medicaid and welfare. So in other words, you've got 9% of your revenue is going to the poor. And that's a big chunk. And so naturally, somebody in that situation is saying, hey, the poor cost too much money. This is ridiculous. Switch it around. Under a financial settlements tax, if you're earning $100,000, you're going to end up paying $125 in taxes. Out of that, $12 is going to pay for the poor. If you're earning $100,000, $12 covering welfare looks like a bargain. It's not a problem anymore. If you bumped it up to $14, you actually would eradicate poverty in our country. And what that would do to the economy would really benefit most any company that you might work for earning $100,000. You'd be better off too. And so you look at it, you don't, once you have the paradigm shift, you're no longer in the same fight that you used to be.
Now, you're saying that with this paradigm shift that you want to move banking towards a 21st century perspective.
Yeah.
And it's currently, you know, that's what you're saying before.
Yeah.
So I think
yeah.
that's a good way to get these ideas across is that, you know, we're dealing
yeah.
with a 19th century system. So could you go into
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Yeah. Our banking system, our financial operating system, and our taxation system all evolved in the 19th century. And it's only natural that as you enter to the 21st century, technology and everything is going to be so radically different, you're going to have to shift the operating system. You're not going to buy a Mac computer built in 1985 and put today's operating system on it and expect it to work. It won't. And that's all it is. You know, our monetary system is an operating system. And so that was the way I approached this. I said, well, it's the 21st century. I'm looking at the movement of goods, services, and, you know, technology, and how does everything actually operate? And I said, what would be the most optimal overlay to put on top of that? Because it would help to stimulate the actual real economy we have, and we would all be better off. That's all there is to it. There's no real magic to it in terms of what you're trying to do. You begin, when you begin to look at it that way, you just realize how arcane and old-fashioned the operating system we have and we have today, no wonder we're having the political fights we're having. It's and by the way, if you don't change operating systems, it's only going to get worse. This divide that we see is only going to polarize the nation greater and greater, and what we're doing is crippling this technologically advanced society that we have. We're crippling it unnecessarily.
A lot of politicians are talking about these issues. You're actually from a financial background. Can you talk about your experience working on Wall Street and some of the observations that you've had of the industry? And what are some of the unique skills that you have that the other candidates don't?
Well, I think it is that background that allowed me to come up with a solution, these solutions. So I've, like when I said, I've always been on the cutting edge. In 1990, I was in the financial community, and I was involved in financing commercial real estate. So not everybody's old enough to remember that in 1990 we had the savings and loan crisis, followed on the heels of George Bush Sr.'s tenure in office. And that was a crash that probably was worse than the one in 2007. And we had a liquidity crisis, an incredible liquidity crisis. And back then, loans came from banks. Mortgages came from banks. They came from life insurance companies, too, and to an extent, pension funds. So they came from these institutions. And so the cost of funds, when you did it that way, made it so that we had interest rates of around 10%. That was the cost of a mortgage back then. And what I looked at it was, is there another source of money? Is there another way we can actually do this? So I was one of the pioneers in structured finance. And by turning to the street for your cost, for your funds, mortgages went down to 4.5%, 5%. That cut the cost of a mortgage more than in half back then. So already we've done this thing where we've taken the cost of funds and recharacterized it and redid it, and it dropped the cost of a mortgage dramatically in the early 90s. It really kind of took full force around 93, 94, 95. And if you look at what happened to the economy in those years, that's when it began to boom. And things took off because we were basically adding a new financial technology to the community. We were changing the operating system, as I like to say. And structured finance became the cornerstone to a booming economy under Bill Clinton, where we actually did not even have a deficit in those years. Now, the nature of man is he gets a little greedy. And structured finance was grossly perverted. And the underwriting standards that we established in the 90s were forgotten when they introduced credit default swaps. And sure enough, a powerful technology, when abused, is causes a powerful fall. So I've been very involved in introducing technologies that have made a big difference to not only the U.S. economy, but the global economy. And I've seen where properly implemented, they work wonders. And when you abuse them and you don't handle it right, they'll bring a nation to its knees. Another little thing like that was with Nelson Mandela in South Africa. When he came to power, he wanted to develop programs called the Redevelopment Program so that blacks who had been oppressed in South Africa for so many years could begin to pull themselves up and have home ownership. And how do you finance that? And at the time, South Africa itself as a nation did not even have an investment grade rating. And that was a challenge. It took 2 years, but I helped structure that and put that together so his RDP redevelopment program was financed, and it brought housing to lots of people there at very low cost, and it worked very well. So I've been involved in financial things for a long time and very good at structuring them and figuring out a better way to do it. Better, cheaper, faster. That's what it's all about.
Do you think that restructuring can fix cultural divides? You brought that up earlier, these divides that are happening now, and
well,
they'll just get worse. Do you think that? Yeah.
Well, okay, so that's a a wonderful question. I didn't pay you to ask that question.
Okay.
Okay. So I'll give you two examples. Cultural divides on the global scenario are best solved by economic interdependence and doing business with each other. If you look at how rapidly China evolved away from communism and socialistic philosophy. Now, they still call it the Communist Party, but it's pretty capitalistic over there now. That happened because Nixon let China come in, you know, began to put the barriers down. We began to do business with each other. It took off like wildfire. And both countries have financially benefited materially from that. And contrast that to Cuba, where we isolated them. The culture has not changed as fast over there as it has in China. Now, it will be a wonderful thing to observe over the next 5 years, 10 years. You'll see changes within Cuba that are tremendous, but people like to do business with each other because they like to profit off the business they do with each other. Nobody does business with each other unless they're making a profit. And the idea of real business is both sides profit. That's the way it is. It's not a net zero sum game. It's a synergistic game in which everybody does better, which is why we don't all live in caves today. You know, if it were a net zero sum game, we'd still be living in caves like we used to. You know, So they do business with each other. And so same thing in the United States. The gulf between the poor and the rich today, when the rich are footing the bill at the rate that they're footing the bill, and the poor are not really receiving the financial stimulus that would allow them to move up. They're kind of locked into the welfare state. You have a cultural divide, and you have animosity towards each other. But if you start running the models, the economic models on the plan that I show, you're going to start throwing people out of poverty and moving them into middle class very rapidly. And guess who benefits? People that own the large companies that now have a larger consumer base to sell to.
You touched upon the issues of trade. And with China, we have a massive trade deficit. How would you address trade deficits? This issue has been brought up in the election. And then there's also the issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What are your overall views on having fair trade, and would you support a tariff?
I don't believe in tariffs. I'm like Ronald Reagan. I believe in free trade. And Ronald Reagan was an amazing conservative in that he stuck to his guns on that. What I would say is, as you can tell, I'm a bit of a contrarian at the way I look at everything. And it's almost like don't air this interview in China, because a trade deficit actually benefits the United States. And the way you look at that is I call it viewing countries from a distance. So let's say you're observing Earth from outer space, and you go back to the days of the Romans, okay? The Roman Empire. What did you see with material goods and services with the Roman Empire? You saw Rome here, and you saw all the people around the Mediterranean building things, making things, transporting them to Rome, and Rome gets materially wealthier. The reason they did that is because the Romans had the centurions they sent out, and they had a military force, and they taxed the people, and they forced them to send everything. But basically, from an the perspective of looking from a 100,000-foot view, goods and services flow to Rome, and Rome gets materially wealthier, and there's a cost to Rome, and that's the military cost. You go through all of empires that have ever existed, that's what happens. Goods and services flow to the power center of the empire. You can look at England, same thing, very powerful. They colonize, and they use legal systems so that the cost of having the goods and services flow into London were much lower on a per capita basis than Rome. You look at America today, we have the best empire building system ever. We simply send paper overseas, and they send us tractors, planes, cars, whatever we want. They send it to us, and we get materially wealthier. And they're hooked on it. If we're not buying those goods and services, they're an export economy, and they think, and it's an irony, because really, if you were looking at it from that perspective, they ought to keep the goods and services they make and enjoy it. They just don't have any way to have a consumer base to buy them. And what they are is, if you look at what I was saying, the cure for our country is that the consumer base is strengthened by eliminating income taxes and by better social programs that don't cost much, you know, in terms of taxation. And our economy booms because the consumer base has grown and producers can sell more and they make more profits, okay? Well, that's China's problem. They have no consumer base at all. They have very little hope at stimulating that. We are the beneficiaries of that arrangement. And it's almost like it's so good, it's almost too good to be true. It's so good I almost hesitate to say this in a public forum for fear that they'll pick up on it. You see what I'm saying, though? It's a very interesting analysis.
How do you address the issue of jobs going overseas with the trade? Basically, a huge portion of our manufacturing jobs have gone overseas.
Yeah, now that's a good question, and that is a problem, okay? Because where that becomes a problem is it erodes the ability of the consumer base to spend because they're not having income. So that is true. On the other side of the coin, we do benefit. If somebody produces it at half the cost and we get to buy it cheaper, we do benefit. And so if you actually go through, so if you look at my entire 10-point proposal, which I call the 10 financial commandments, five of those points have to do with fiscal responsibility. Five of them have to do with social programs. And one of them is a national income. So as production becomes more and more efficient, whether it's in our country or somewhere else, what happens is the financial industry grows so fast that small payments tax is enough that you can begin to pay a national income to people. And if you kind of extrapolate this problem out, say, 50 years, you know, way out there, kind of take that Star Trek view, what you realize is that as automation increases, as robots increase, as drones increase, as all of this increases, a smaller and smaller percentage of our population is going to be working anyway. And as that percentage of our population begins to shrink, unless we have a means of putting money in the hands of citizens in this country through something like a national income, Fed dividends, and things like that, we are harming ourselves. And today, with income tax, there's no way you can have a national income because that's just a redistribution of income. You have to have things like payments taxes and financial settlements tax to begin to be sweeping money out of the monetary economy and into the hands of consumers so the consumers can spend it. So it's the problem of some jobs going overseas is dwarfed by the fact that technology is going to make most jobs obsolete fairly soon. And you need an operating system that addresses that problem.
So with like a basic income, like one proposal is that money coming from tax revenue, but what you're saying is it's similar to social credit?
Yeah. Well, so there's two problems you have to solve. If you are trying to put a national income or social credit, whatever you want to call it, based upon income taxes being your source of revenue, it's an impossible problem. You know, it just doesn't work. That's just a redistribution of other people's income. Then you go to the next one, which is sort of that social credit saying, hey, the Fed can just print the money and give it to people and let's do that. Well, then you flood the money supply. And so really the purpose of a payments tax is, you know, if you have the money, if you have such a huge volume of movement of money that you can just skim a small piece off of each of these payments that are made, and that is sufficient money to actually fund a national income so people can actually go out there and spend things whether or not they're working. So the people who work have more to spend. And that would stimulate the economy. That works because you're not flooding the money supply anymore. You have to have enough movement of money that you can skim a small piece off so that every dollar that you're paying out as a social credit or national income or whatever you want to call it is being filtered back out through that payments tax. Because otherwise, I mean, it's perfectly possible today to go to the Federal Reserve and Congress to say, I want you to give everybody in the country $25,000 a year. And if you did that, you're just going to have inflation through the roof because you're flooding the money supply. You have to have a mechanism to pull it back out of the money supply. So it's a different way of looking at it. It's not income taxes. It's how do we finance all this stuff and how do we pull it back out of the money supply on the backside?
I have a question. It's kind of a silly one, but it's how can you explain these ideas in most layman terms possible? Because I hear what you're saying, but it's a bit complicated.
No, you're nailing the biggest problem I have. The biggest problem that I personally have is how do you put this in layman's terms? And so, in the book that I wrote, The 10 Financial Commandments. That's my best efforts to put it in layman's terms. And I think I nailed it in the book. The challenge I have is when I talk about it, it gets a little more complicated because I get excited and I talk about what we can do with it. And the truth is, it's like let's say, you know, you're an investor and you're not a technical investor. And you want to make an investment, and you realize in the computer world, you realize there's going to be a lot of money to be made in the Internet of Things or in software or something like that. The guy you're going to hire to actually accomplish that for you, he's going to be technical. If he's not, your business is going to fail. And so this is another big problem we have in our country today. The guys that run Congress, our elected politicians, the regular Joes, you know, they're not technically proficient in computer technology, software technology, financial technologies.
And is that why we still have a 19th century system?
And that's why we still have a 19th century. Until we begin to put people in a position of decision-making that have the technical know-how that I've been expressing to change the economy, it ain't going to happen. So technology, there needs to be leadership that has this level of technical expertise in Washington in order to implement this. It's just not easy. You got to have somebody who understands it. And so that's where our society is going to have to go, or we're going to limp along.
A lot of these ideas tie into the healthcare crisis.
Yeah.
And no one's really putting forth any solutions to healthcare on either side. But
yeah.
You make the point that one point you make is that we pay $10,000 a year per person on healthcare, which is three times as much as what a lot of other nations pay, which have much higher quality of health care. And with health insurance, the problem is it's the same with what I said about what you were saying about the mortgages. You put in far more money goes to the profits of the health insurance companies than you actually get that pays towards health care. Originally, the intention of insurance was that people just pooled their resources together. But then it became a massive like for-profit industry.
Yeah, right. It used to be just for catastrophic care, and people paid for their regular care on their own. And if the health insurance company was just catastrophic, it would be about a tenth of what the size is today. So it's turned into this huge monstrous beast. But so I've read through a lot of studies of where the waste is and where all that is, and that is one of the big areas. But another big area, 35 to 50% of the money that we spend each year is even the health insurance companies characterize it as waste or unnecessary procedures. And primarily that comes from, you need tort reform out there because, a third of the doctor's income is often for malpractice insurance. The hospitals pay a huge amount for that. And the response of the medical community to the threat of being sued is, a guy comes in, he has a headache. You give them 20 different tests that might cost $10,000, And you can't afford to say, take an aspirin and see me tomorrow because maybe he's having a stroke, And so I think you need tort reform, and I think you need my plan, I call it the American Medical Account, is everybody has a certain amount of money to spend, come through that payments tax, and you can go buy good old-fashioned insurance if you want. But if you allow tort reform, you could allow provider groups, those are the doctors, to band together. And it's pretty interesting. You get a group of about 50 doctors together, they can provide for about 99% of what their patients would need. So a very small catastrophic override would be necessary. And there are groups out there right now, and at the rate of $2,500 to $3,000 a year, they take care of their patients. And so it requires a systemic change. You need people buying the services directly from their doctors directly or choosing to do insurance, and you need to authorize and legitimize doctors coming into their own provider groups, and the decision is between the doctor and the patient as to what to do, and the doctor's not worried about being sued. And suddenly the doctor's making choices because he knows he's getting, say, the $4,000 a year the government is paying into this American medical account. That's what he has to use to take care of the guy. You can provide basic health care for that, and the doctor will figure out how to keep his overhead low to do that. Suddenly you don't have the waste and unnecessary tests are done. I was shocked at the degree that unnecessary tests are done in the medical community. They're just trying, it's a CYA, cover their butt type of thing.
Which candidates do you see coming close to your ideas? I know Donald Trump has talked about corporate inversions. Do you see any of your ideas in these candidates?
Yeah, that's a good. All of them have an element of it. Like Bernie Sanders on some of his social spending. Donald Trump on a number of the business angles. Cruz on some of his, some of his ways of trying to cut through waste and things like that. But they're all operating from a handicapped position because they're operating from, they're operating by seeing a point of pain in the 19th century operating system that we have. And how do you solve that point of pain in the old paradigm? And the answer is not very well. You're not really going to be able to squeeze that much red tape out of any of this. They're all kind of fooling themselves. And our debt is mushrooming. The deficit is, it's moderate at $400 billion right now. I mean, it's kind of almost a crime that somebody's saying a $400 billion a year deficit is moderate. But we are in a system that is hemorrhaging. And so you've got guys standing around this hemorrhaging system saying, hey, I think I can fix a little of this. And when you run the analysis, none of their solutions are all that powerful. And they're handicapped. Until you come up with this new view, all solutions under the old view are all going to be second rate. So my hope in being heard is things will get worse and worse and worse. Where I'm really putting my time and energy is with very sophisticated, financially sophisticated people in the Wall Street front, in the PE area, who, I can talk to about this, and they're like, "Ooh, I get that. You're right." And analysts in the think tanks in the Washington D.C. area, I've found that those analysts are, they're pretty good. And I've got I've got a number of people there within the Beltway who are in the big think tanks who are saying, you know, Scott, I think you might have something. So I think it's coming out with sort of the talking heads who say, this plan would work, and the other plans are kind of second rate because they're operating under the old paradigm.
Are you facing any opposition? I know that, you know, making changes to the Federal Reserve would probably, you know, rustle a few jimmies, as they say.
That's a good, so it's kind of interesting. I have had conversations with people in the Federal Reserve, okay. And some of them are pretty grand, are good supporters. Others of them, you just wonder where they're coming from, you know, and some of them are get pretty, have a lot of angst about what I say. Let's leave it at that. So the way I view it is you want to get a lot of smart people who are starting to get behind this. You want to keep the, you know, the website, the book, the information on a simple level so people read it. I've, on the website, in the next few days, we're going to be introducing some scribe videos, you know, where somebody's writing on a whiteboard. And to a T, those have come back with 90%+ of the people watching it saying, I get that. I want to do it. And it's on the payments tax. So I think we've solved that problem. And our main thing is you kind of hang your hat on a couple of the simple ideas. So it's basically my message to John Doe is, here's a way to eliminate the income tax for you. Think of how that would change your life. And at the same time, there'll be no deficit. And you can imagine how the economy would respond if all the people, all the taxpayers in this country, citizens of this country, really did have more money to spend, and we would have a real economic boom. That I think keeping it encapsulated at that level, that's the basic message going out. That's what will be on Twitter, Facebook, and the website. And then, you know, people say, too good to be true, he must be crazy, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and then that's where me being a little technical on this as I talk to people won't hurt. They'll say, he sure sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
Definitely.
That's my hope, you know. We've put very little energy into it so far. I'm in a position where I'm a founder of a number of different startup companies that are starting to mature. And as those are sold, I'll have more time and I'll have more capital to devote to this. And I'll, you know, come November, it's not the end of my quest.
Are you putting a lot of your personal money into things like advertisement?
Right now, a limited amount, but it is all coming from me. I'm only putting my money in at this stage. It's while my startups are at the stage that they're at, I'm constrained in the amount of money I can put into this. If the companies sell for what we're expecting, I may actually be able to finance this at a pretty high level.
How much of success have you had with getting your message across on social media?
We're just starting that. That's actually, so the early metrics in just a couple of weeks of very small testing is that we do attract attention at about four times the normal. You know, it costs us a fourth to grab somebody to do a like and get them to sign up. So that's kind of nice. And the small group of people, they're quite passionate. You know, I think that if somebody comes to the conclusion that they actually wouldn't have to pay income tax anymore and everything actually would be better, they're kind of saying, why aren't we doing this?
Have you thought of a sort of a short, like, catchy campaign slogan, that like something like zero income tax, keep your benefit?
Yes, zero DDT solution. The zero DDT solution, zero debt, zero deficit, zero income taxes. Yeah, this is the zero income taxes, zero deficit, zero debt solution. But it's more than that. That sort of skips the social piece to this.
So we've covered a lot of the economic and financial issues. What are your stances on some of the other issues? You talk about some of them, Well, obviously, it's all related to the financial issues, but one of them is
related
you talk.
To the, yeah, I have. So on the website,
about,
I have my stand on the issues. So I have like drugs, you know, illegal drugs. What's the stand there? In education, and they so often do tie back to finances. And the way I look at something is sort of finances. So my view on drugs, I reside in the state of Colorado, and I've gotten to sit back and watch as marijuana was legalized. I understand that every first grader in Colorado got an iPad. I don't know if that is factually true. Somebody is telling me that today because of our marijuana tax. And I know that it has generated revenue for our state, and I don't see any difference. You know, when I look across the vista there. So it seems like legalizing marijuana and taxing it at 25% like we do probably is an economically very wise thing to do. So you're no longer spending tax dollars on criminalizing and then throwing people in jail. Instead, you're receiving revenue out of the issue. So I'm a supporter of legalizing marijuana.
One area where it does tie in with the financial issues is that a lot of banking... And the banking industry does own shares in, like, the private prison companies.
Right. Yeah, the private prison companies have, well, so when we began the war on drugs, we anywhere from tripled to quintupled, 3 to 5 times as many people on a per capita basis being incarcerated. And who pays the bill for that? The taxpayers pay the bill for that. You know, privatized the prisons, it sounds like maybe they'll run them more efficiently, but now you suddenly have this constituency that's making a profit off of the prisons. It's like, whoa, these are all triple whammies hitting us. This is not what we want to do, you know. My view on illegal drugs beyond marijuana is they're a big business. There are a lot of people making huge profits off of it. We're paying the bill of incarcerating, you know, 5 times as many people as we need to. I would say legalize all of those drugs, but eliminate it. Only the government can pay for it, can sell them, okay? And they sell them at a low cost. And so suddenly, I mean, you're always going to have the problem of the addicted people, but you're far better off if the government is selling them heroin and meth and all those terrible things, and you're bringing revenue into the government, and now you can do some education and some counseling and rehab with the revenue that's coming in. And guess what you've done to the drug lords throughout Central America? You've just effectively pulled the rug out from underneath them. I mean, drugs are being sold cheap. The American government is selling them, and they're making the money off of it. Goodbye, drug problem throughout Central America.
You don't think that would be a little controversial, though? Like,
oh,
a legal process for buying heroin?
Yeah, of course it's going to be controversial. But I look at the economics of it. I'm like, we're paying through the nose for the problem. So here's a way that, you know, you're not paying through the nose anymore. And have you increased the problem? No. You know, I don't think so. I think you've decreased the problem if you're making money off of it and you're doing some good educational types of programs, maybe you're actually helping these people. The drug addict is somebody who has a problem. He's not a criminal. He's somebody with a serious problem. And so, yeah. You know, I don't care if things are controversial. What I always do is just say, look, here's the best, most efficient, best way to solve it. You know, if it never gets passed, I mean, I don't care. I just want to point out the best way to solve it.
You have a platform about immigration, and you're saying that with a lot of your financial reforms, you're saying that the impacts it would have on Mexico's economy would make it so it would not be as necessary to build a wall?
Well, I think you're always, I am strong on immigration. You've got to be careful. You've got to protect your borders. And but what my point there is that the magnitude of the problem is, you know, how many hundreds of millions of people are trying how desperately to get into your country. The worse off their nation is, the worse the problem is you have. And so, yep, border patrols and all of that. But if you really want to try to get to the root of the problem, banking 2.0, the way I've described that, is a solution whereby private banks in America would have much more firepower in investing in those foreign countries. And they're investing for profit. They're investing to build factories, to build infrastructure, but they're investing at a very low cost basis. Okay? And so what they're doing is our nation's banking become the international financiers out there, and we're building that infrastructure, we're doing it low cost, we're doing it so it's profitable. But we have an advantage over any other banking system by doing that. And so by building out that infrastructure, you're going to improve the economies in those neighboring countries, and you are reducing the immigration problem. You're not eliminating it, you know. But
even with these reforms, there's always going to be extreme poverty in the world. I mean, even that's something that's just always going to be with us.
Yeah. All you can do is improve situations. You don't eradicate situations or erase them. Right now, a lot of the things we're doing are making the situation worse, and then we're wondering why the problem gets harder for us. So I'm not saying I have this little silver bullet, you just do this and suddenly the problem's gone. I'm saying you can reduce the problem if you do financing properly. And you're still going to have Border Patrol.
Scott, I wish Trump had your same demeanor when he was talking about these issues, because I think you're able to explain it in a much more sensible way.
Yeah. That's the people who know me and who are supporting this are like your demeanor and your way of approaching things. You're a very good leader.
Yeah, and you're also you have a nice Mr. Rogers thing going on.
You do, and
yeah, which
has served me well.
Yeah, definitely.
Served me well all my life. It's I've always been in the leadership, of all the companies I've been involved in, and starting charter schools. I've always been a leader. I've always been that person. But it's because there's what I bring to the table: some clarity and a nice demeanor, and a focus on a win-win solution, and that is always the thing that moves forward the fastest. So if you look through the 10-point program that I put together, you find Democrats and Republicans both tremendously benefiting. You find the poor and the rich benefiting, and then you also find that our international relations will be improved. And it's always seeking win-win solutions is always the way to go.
One other issue with banking is, like, for things like infrastructure projects and even education, the government actually borrows money to fund those projects from private banks at interest. So some people have put out the proposal of a public bank. So then that would eliminate that interest in that. What are your thoughts on, like, public banking?
I think public banking is a good idea. I think that banking 2.0 kind of just leapfrogs one step beyond it. And if you go through the depths of what I'm proposing in banking 2.0, anything that you could do with public banking, you can do with banking 2.0 a little better and a little more efficiently. But is my sentiment with people like Ellen Brown, very good on public banking and how they describe it. And, actually, she and I see eye to eye on so many things. I just applaud her for being one of the early pioneers out there. There are a lot of people. Hazel Henderson's a really sharp person. There's a lot of people in our country that have been proposing alternatives to banks. And as I've gotten to know them, in general, they'll say, oh, yeah, this really solves a lot of these problems. I think that even if you had banking 2.0, you might have room for, like North Dakota has a bank, a state bank. You still have room for some things like that for special purposes that banking 2.0 wouldn't address. So I'm all for that.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else that I didn't get a chance to touch upon and that you would like to get across to our audience?
I think you guys have done an amazing job of covering things. I'm a little blown away by the depths of your questions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Really, remarkable solutions. So I would really recommend everyone in our audience to check out your website at scottsmith2016.com and to check out his book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book is called The 10 Financial Commandments. That's the new book. I've got several out there, but that one, I think that's an 80-some page read. It's fast. It's easy. And the reaction of most people when they read it is, tell me why we're not already doing this. So I think we might have articulated our messages in that book properly.
Great.
Well, Scott Smith, thanks again for being on, and also thanks, Alex, for co-hosting.
It's been great. It's been really great.
Well, Alex, I've enjoyed meeting you, and Robert, thank you for the show. And I'll come back anytime you want. You guys are doing a real service, asking the right questions and digging in. And I believe at some point in time, some of this stuff catches on fire and eventually it gets into the national dialogue.
Yeah, I mean,
thanks,
I can see that paradigm shift happening. So,
I think there's a shift happening. The point of pain when you don't shift grows, and eventually that becomes the impetus for the shift.
Exactly.
And we're seeing that in this election, that's for sure. All right. It was a pleasure talking to both of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.